We get things started like we do every Tuesday by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. His latest book, there are many more coming. The latest is Meatheads Say the Realest Things. It's brilliant. It's funny. It's poignant. It's awesome. You should get it. It's available everywhere. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball? Can you hear me all right?
I hear you. It sounds like you're on a phone several hundred miles away. Perfect.
Yeah, you sound the same.
It's working. All good. Are you in an undisclosed location today?
No, I'm not. I just noticed when Carrie called that I was having a hard time hearing him, so I didn't know what was going on exactly. I didn't know if he'd be able to hear me.
Well, he's drinking again, so it's not. Try not to let it impact the show, but it is what it is.
All right. I hear you, man. Speak up. I might have a phone issue. I'm not sure what's going on here.
All right. Well, we got a lot of things to cover. And let's start with a couple classic radio shows. I loved this episode of X-1 that you sent along called Skulking Permit. Strange things happening on the planet of New Delaware.
Yes, it's funny. It's a very funny, witty episode. And I sent you the one. There are actually two versions of it from X-1. One is from early 56 and the other is from July 4th, 57. So the one from 56 is longer and it's better. I'm pretty sure that's the one that I
it is.
Sent
yep.
you. It was written by an author named Robert Sheckley, who would imbue his writings with a lot of wit, a lot of satire. Nowadays, I'm wondering, though, like if right from the jump, from the word skulking, people will be like, I don't know that word. It's a fancy vocabulary word, which is just a quite depressing notion. But it's this colony, like you said, called New Delaware, an Earth colony on some other planet. And the overseers of Mother Earth, as it's called throughout the segment, they haven't been in touch. They haven't supervised in over 200 years. And in the process, what has grown up is a kind of utopia. So they want the Earth people, they want these other Earth members to carry on in a proper earthy tradition, is a verbal joke that goes throughout the segment. And so they don't have any crime. So they have to appoint a criminal. A guy who has the skulking permit of the title to do thieving and to really take it across the goal line to commit a murder.
Right, right. But he has to have a motive. It's important because on Earth, you always have a motive.
Yes, they have this like primer. They have a textbook. So it sends up all of these tropes of our lawless society in some ways. We have laws, but people infrequently heed them, and we certainly are not heeding moral laws all that often. So it becomes very, I don't want to say tongue-in-cheek, because when something's tongue-in-cheek, it's not usually like that funny. But this guy, Tom Fisher, he's the town fisherman, and that's considered a gory job. That's the goriest job anyone has. So the mayor appoints him to be the skulker and the eventual murderer, because, as he says, you have narrow eyes, and all criminals have narrow eyes. So, and the guy's like, do I really? Are they that narrow? So he goes to this bar, and to accentuate that he's going to the other side of the tracks, although it's the only bar in the little village, it's not even a town, you hear like the trumpet plunger, the mute, and wah, wah, like we're going to the bad side of town. And he says to the bartender, he's like, well, this is now... It's my criminal lair. It's like my den of ill repute. he narrates as he's going through, like he's this play-by-play guy doing the ball game. And so they get some red paint and they put it on this. And they don't even know that the school is supposed to be like red. They paint the church red.
Right. Yeah. No, so churches have to be white. Don't you know that?
Yeah. So they don't really know anything. And he does the thieving. And so like one guy's like, hey, can I have my tool back? I just need it for a couple hours. He's like, well, I stole it. Like, fair. By the book. I went by the book. I'm doing all of this right. So he has to pick a guy to kill. And meanwhile, and I like how you have this mashup, too, of the ecological and then sci-fi. That's not done that often. You see this dot in the sky, and it's it's the Earth people coming to inspect the colony. What they really want to do is conscript people, draft them, force them to be cannon fodder in the wars they're now having to fight because people have rebelled on other like planets, and it's not going so well. So he hits upon this master plan for what he's finally going to do that will have great motive for this murder, and it just cracks me up every time. I don't know if anyone would get this joke now. He decides he's going to kill the inspector, so he jumps out for fame and for infamy, all of that. He jumps out and he yells, "Halt, stand and deliver," which, like I said, no one would know that, but if you were a highwayman and you robbed people in the 1700s in England, you'd leap out along some path from behind a rock and yell, "Halt, stand and deliver." So that's exactly what he does here.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's a brilliant, it's funny, and it's got a message, too. So check it out, X-1, the episode Skulking Permit. From there to another old radio series, and we've talked about it a few times before. Quiet Pleas can be hit or miss. I like this one a lot. I thought this episode was really good, and to me it had some real echoes in many ways of Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
I think suspense is the one that can be hit and miss. There aren't enough Quiet Pleas episodes for them to really fail. They're very consistent. There aren't that many of them. The thing that's tricky about Quiet Pleas is that a lot of the episodes haven't been very well preserved. So it can be an adjustment for one's ears listening to them. But this is from late January 1949. And it does something quite interesting temporally because it happens in a kind of real time. Like the narrator and his partner, his lab partner, they're doing these experiments in teleportation up above the 49th parallel. So they're seeing the northern lights in the sky. That's where we're at. So I don't remember if it's like Canada or is it upstate New York, but it's something along those lines. It doesn't really matter. And so he references, he says, this happened about a month and a half ago. Around like before Christmas. And so you really do have that sort of real timeline chronology. And he says, I'm going to play this tape for you of what was going on in the lab. He says, I think the quality is okay for you to listen to it. So it's like a broadcast within a broadcast. And they're trying to move this lighter into a different dimension. And then to catch up with it, they can move it any time, but they're just going to do it like 10 seconds. So they don't have to sit around and wait. And they end up bringing back this caterpillar. And it seems quite simple, except it's from this very cold place, and it should be like this frozen caterpillar popsicle, but it's not.
No, and it communicates the five vowels, and that's what to me was reminiscent of when Francois Truffaut is doing the little hand gestures to the aliens. Do, 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 do.
Right, I agree. And I think, too, that whole Close Encounters of the Third Kind thing. But you see the vowels, like it when it becomes that sweeping, elegiac moment, I think we've talked about this at some point at the end of The Great Gatsby. And as I sat there brooding on the old unknown world, and as I sat there, A-E-I-O-U. So he's taking language right back to its essence. And you have this being, and this being is going to be voiced. This caterpillar, who, as it turns out, sings. I mean, it's not like Jerry Lee Lewis singing, but it does a kind of singing, is voiced by the same person who does the voice of the creature from Subterranean Depths in The Thing on the Forbo Board. So a bit of like radio trivia train spotting. And it's just one of those visits that you don't want to have, because this caterpillar that seems so benign isn't really benign. And caterpillar is just has shown up more often than we might think in supernatural and sci-fi fiction. There's a great instance, and people can look this up. I'm sure it's in the public domain. You can find it on Project Gutenberg. There's a E.F. Benson story called Caterpillars, which is very creepy. So this is a creepy sci-fi caterpillar. That was a horror caterpillar, the sci-fi caterpillar. And it takes over Ernest Chappell's voice near the end. The partner, it does not work out so well for him. But I think, too, what makes these episodes so appealing, you have the horror and you have the atmosphere, and it's so well written. I'll put up the script later, the full script of this. I'll put it up on my blog. But it's so convivial. You like listening to these two guys have their banter, their back and forth. They're hanging out with each other. They're in jokes that you start to pick up on. And it just pulls you in a way that sets you up for things that are going to be done to you.
Give a listen to it. It's Quiet Please. Northern Lights is the episode, and it's out there on YouTube and several other outlets. Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. You wrote a piece recently in news about the Cleveland baseball team's name change, and I thought you hit on something important in all of this. They seem to be somewhat lazy. Guardians, whatever you call it, it seems like it was just the least objectionable thing that some committee could come up with.
I think that's what you see as a whole across society. When you have, like, we've talked about this before, I just became banned by everyone in publishing. It's like ironic that we're always talking about something that came out. But again, that's complicated. But I always had the experience of, if you had, you could have the best short story ever written, and if more than one person, especially these freaks, got together and had to agree upon it, like, they were always going to take the safest, least meaningful, least consequential thing. And I would joke, although it was true, that they were looking for works that sucked, that bored, and that matched other works that sucked and bored. So suck, bored, bore, match is kind of the key to a lot of things. And then that's what gets put out, because you have these 30 group representations of people saying, well, this bothered me. It's like, oh, I thought we ironed all this out. It's like, no, that was one more thing. Okay, throw that away. Is there anything here that is just totally benign? It's like a saucerful of warm milk that we can put out. And that's what you're left with. And then everything comes out, and something has to win. Somebody has to go first. Take first place. Take the gold medal, to use an Olympic analogy. And then you just end up praising stuff that sucks. Because something has to have, whether it's the Oscar or the Pulitzer or the Emmy or the Guggenheim or the Genius Grant, whatever it is, it's all crap that was pre-approved by some committee-type thinking where the essence wasn't on quality. It wasn't someone making a decision, this is best, let's rip it, let's throw it, let's see what people think. It was, this one's has the least amount of life in it. I'm sure it'll be fine. No one's going to come for us.
And that's the problem in any of these situations, is when you go to the least common denominator, and the key is always, well, what's the least offensive? What will cause us as a committee or as decision makers the smallest amount of grief? Rather than taking a stand and saying, we're going with this because we think this is the best name and it's a killer. And if you don't like it, well, get used to it because we've made our decision.
Which itself is offensive, which is truly offensive, because it's saying you are a dolt, a plebeian. You can't think, you can't enjoy anything. We have to spoon feed you this gruel because you're just a dumbass, which is hugely offensive. And it's like, you go on social media, and you just, for instance, to give one example, you're bombarded with Star Wars crap. Like, you cannot get away with it. You can't get away from people's crazy theories about, is there canon or non-canon? Because I think Darth Hideous was doing this back in the Maleficent age, or whatever it is. It's just everywhere. But then you think about, like, the roots of that film. And people were saying, and this is how it is with everything that's any good or different. People are saying, you can't do this. This isn't going to work. People won't. It's not the right time. You can do that. You can go back to Disney and Snow White in 1937. You can go back to the Beatles. Bands with the guitars are on the way out. These are things that are so popular, they become the pop cultural wallpaper, the inescapable wallpaper of the world that we can't get away from, even if you don't like those things. It can become like torture. You're just going to have to experience the Beatles. And so it's so counterintuitive to do things in this manner where you're not appeasing anyone. And really, the larger takeaway is that you create this culture where mediocrity just rules everything. And you're told this thing that is just some crap bag production oh, it's like the Shakespeare of its time. Well, it's like it's not. You just have to have someone bend down and put the metal around them, and this is all that you let through to have the chance. I think that's one thing about sports, too, which makes it ironic here. It is the last, for now at least, it is the last meritocracy in America. Almost nothing happens because something is good, someone's great at something, someone outworks somebody. There are always other reasons. And look at this just sucking chest wound of a culture, of our collective morality as a result. Sure, it's just sports. It's just a silly name for a baseball team. But it's indicative of a much larger theme, I think.
While we're on the subject of baseball, let's talk about a couple of outfielders who some think should be in the Hall of Fame. Not there yet. I'm not sure that they'll get there anytime soon, though they were very good. They would certainly be in the Hall of very good, if not great, Dwight Evans and Dale Murphy.
I've been thinking about a few other players, too. So the idea of this is those two guys and a lot of people, especially for Murphy, really, really banged the drum, Baseball Movie, for his inclusion, and for Dwight Evans, too. And I should preface this by saying that I really like Dwight Evans. It's going to sound like I don't like Dwight Evans, but I was a big Dwight Evans admirer, fan, grew up watching Dwight Evans, and I felt like you really knew you were enjoying a Boston Red Sox game when, like, Dewey came up and he had this distinctive batting stance that you imitated while you were playing wiffle ball. But I've created this term that's very not sabermetric-y called the proud of its season. When you look at a season that someone had, is it a season to be proud of? For instance, if you're a corner outfielder, and this is kind of a Dale Murphy season, and you had 24 home runs and like 77 RBI, and you look at all the other advanced stats or whatever, that's not a proud of its season. A proud of its season is like 30 home runs, 102 RBI, or 26 home runs and 88 RBI and 311 batting average. Like, proud of it. Do you feel like if you were that player and the season wrapped and you were back home, did you think to yourself, I was proud of that campaign I just had? And really, if you have 10 proud of it seasons, you're a Hall of Fame type guy. But there are some strange numbers I've noticed about Dwight Evans. Like, we've talked before about how he doesn't really become a plus player, let alone hitter. But like, he doesn't become like sort of a plus all-star caliber player until he's deep into his career in 1981. And then in that season, strike season, he's top 10 in WAR, same in 82. But he's never in the top 10 in WAR. And keep in mind, this isn't just batting. This is defense outside of those 2 years, even in 87. Because when he got good at hitting, his defense wasn't that consequential. He wasn't the same outfielder. He was being moved to first base. Mm. So it became like strangely, like he was really good defensively, couldn't hit. Then he could hit, and he wasn't much of a factor defensively. And WAR loves things that Evans was good at. Run scoring, bases on balls, on base percentage, all of that stuff. And he still only cracked WAR top 10 twice. And for all of the talk of his defense, he was only top 10 defensively in WAR twice as well. So I found that just like very surprising based upon how people make a case for him.
And I'm hopelessly biased in favor of Dewey as one of my all-time favorite players. But you're right, the numbers tell the story, and that those proud of it seasons, as you call it, you maybe four or five with Evans, and that might be a stretch.
I'll tell you what really hurts Dwight Evans. So he gets good. In 81, he's great. In 82, he's pretty good. 83, he is just abysmal. I don't know what happened to him. I don't know if he had something going on.
Well, he was hurt, too. He missed about 35 games that year.
He was bad. And then in 85, when everyone on the Red Sox could rake, everybody was destroying the baseball in the Red Sox in 85. They were like an early version of the 2003 Red Sox. They had no pitching whatsoever, but everybody could hit. He was bad in 85. So, like, it's strange. And if you look at his 162... It's strange, the 162 game average. People always cite that, but nobody plays, Cal Ripken, nobody plays 162 games. But if you looked at his 162 for traditional numbers, he's averaging 24 home runs, 86 RBI, 272 batting average.
Right.
Now, you have to factor in his position. He's a corner outfielder. That's just, those are like Gary Carter, Carlton Fisk. Those are catcher offensive numbers. It's just too light in the pocket. As for Murphy, his case boggles my mind. I think Evans is closer than Murphy. Murphy just, he didn't do it long enough. He did it a little bit longer than someone like Don Mattingly. But there aren't enough proud of its seasons. And then you can look at other guys who, Minnie Minoso should definitely be in, but Bobby Abreu, by the proud of it meter, he has like 10 seasons that way.
Oh, absolutely.
Like I'm not saying he should be in. I'm saying that he's someone who's closer than people think. And I have a really sort of out of, well, the mixed baseball metaphors, out of left field idea for you too. And I this hockey kind of with like Guy Carboneau and people like that getting in, Bob Gainey earlier, these defensive specialists. Bob Boone, at the most important, maybe, defensive position ever, was one of the best there's been. He is one of the most impactful defensive players in the history of baseball. Look at his defensive war. So, won a World Series, couldn't hit a lick most years,
yeah.
But you're the field general. You have so much responsibility, especially back then. It wasn't all about analytics and pulling out your index card and knowing to move four steps to your left. The catcher was positioning people. So I'm not saying, of course, he should be in, but he's one of those guys, too, that's closer than you'd think.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. We'll wrap it up today by talking music as we discuss an anniversary of a great album from The Who. 50 years ago, they released their fifth studio album. Who's next?
The Who did not have many studio albums. You'd think, right, that they'd be so deep into just a logjam of studio creations. But as you said, so it's 1971, and they'd started putting out long players back in 65. So they made up for it somewhat with double albums like Tommy and Quadrophenia in a couple of years after Who's Next. But Who's Next was always the one that's been the most critically acclaimed. And it grew out of an aborted session, the Lifehouse sessions. It's supposed to be this big sci-fi concept thing that no one could understand, so it became this streamlined set of songs. I say streamlined because there aren't that many tracks on the album itself, not that they're especially short songs. But for playing, and I was listening to Won't Get Fooled Again recently, the drumming on this record, and I thought of you too, because I know you're not like a hard rock guy, but it infused with a great deal of melody. And the ballads are especially strong, I'd say, for Who record.
Yeah, and we're doing a little special in about a week and a half on the music of 1971, and you can make a case that for a whole lot of bands and solo artists out there, the music that they did in 1971 was the high watermark, and I would say The Who and Who's Next might be an example. I don't know that there's anything they've done in the last 50 years that approaches what they did on that album.
Yeah, I'd say the Quadrophenia is a better record than this, and that might be the best they ever did. It's funny because The Who was just one of the first bands that I was hardcore into, and I've only become more impressed with them over, well, the decades now. I think they're the closest that rock and roll has gotten to Johann Sebastian Bach. I think that Pete Townsend, you can hear it on this album, too. I think he's the greatest rock and roll guitarist. I don't mean like playing for chops and all of that. I mean with the sonic architecture of the guitar and how you can deploy that architecture in the studio process. Like, there aren't that many guitar solos on, well, any Who record, and certainly not on this one. But he'll do things. He'll, like, chop up notes. He'll introduce a leitmotif at one part of a song that will come back in a different key later on in the song. And he was such a rhythmic player because he's not the lead instrument, which was how the guitar would function, certainly at the time, because your drummer, who's not that great at keeping time, is playing sort of the lead voice of the ensemble. So it's a fascinating record. And it's one of the few records, too, I think, where you have such a high synthesizer component. And the synthesizer, especially from back then, is not an instrument that ages really well. Like, it can sound goofy. Mm. Sometimes you watch, like, Criterion Channel right now has all these neo-noirs on, a term I despise, from, like, the 80s. And it's a little hard to take the atmosphere setting up seriously, because you have, like, this cheesy kind of, like, Def Leppard light, like, rock going on, and it just, it doesn't age that well. It's not like string. So they were able to spearhead this utilization of the synthesizer that is just, like, Bach and his Art of Fugue, one of the greatest things a human has ever composed and executed, would listen to this, and it would just make a great deal of sense to them. And then it's just such ballsy rock and roll, too. Like, you can go on YouTube, and if people haven't done this, I would imagine not many people have, you can listen to the isolated drum track from Won't Get Fooled Again. It's just, it'll take the breath out of your chest. It's just some of the most inventive, going back to what we were talking about, playing you'll ever hear, because you're not supposed to play drums like that. But he did, and it worked, because he was working at that level, and he also had the balls to really go for it and to own it.
Colin Fleming. You can subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. You can visit his website at colinflemminglit.com. Colin, we thank you as always, my friend, and we'll check in again next Tuesday.
All right, sounds good.